Attention, attention all personnel. It's MASHcast.
Hello, and welcome to MASHcast, the show that examines, one episode at a time, the greatest TV series of all time, MASH, which ran on CBS from 1972 to 1983. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, I'm your host, Corporal Captain Rob Kelly, and joining us in the VIP tent this week from the Made for TV Mayhem Podcast, Major Amanda Reyes. Hi, Amanda, and welcome to the show.
Wow, I thought I'd start out as a private.
No. Everyone who is nice enough to come on the show, I make at least an officer.
Oh, good. Thank you.
Anyway, thank you so much for doing this. I'm a huge, huge fan of your show, Made for TV Mayhem. For anyone who's listening to this who hasn't heard that show, like, that is, if you want to know anything about TV movies, the art of TV movies, you have to listen to the show, because Amanda and her co-hosts examine the genre in granular detail, and you are absolutely the queen of TV movies. Of that, I have no doubt.
Oh, thank you. I'm really happy to be here. I've been listening to your show, and it's really great. And, I hadn't watched MASH in a while, so it's really like lighting a fire under me to revisit it.
Oh, that's good. It's available on Hulu now, at least, so you can watch it at your leisure. As I ask everybody before we get to the episode in question, which is Edwina from season 1, episode 13, what is your history with the show? Did you watch it? Are you old enough to have watched it when it aired, or did you watch it in reruns? How did you become a fan?
Yeah, I mean, I would have been a baby, I guess, when it premiered, but I grew up watching it, and I guess when I was about 7 or so, the show would have been on for a few seasons, so it went into syndication. And it used to play on our local channel between like 7 and 8 or 6 and 7, 2 episodes. And while it was still in its regular run. So we watched it twice, me and my parents. We watched it twice a night, every weekday, and then sometimes 3 times, because I think it had moved to Monday at some point. You probably know the schedule better than me, but I feel like it was on a weeknight at some point.
Yes, it was.
And we would watch it then too. So we were and it was really interesting because I was too old to fully understand the structure of the show, but, you know, it changed a lot over the years. So I might be watching like a Blake episode that's like more slapsticky and broad in its humor. And then at night I would be watching like the real serious episodes where they got rid of the laugh track and everything was a little bit more sober. And so I would sometimes fluctuate, depending on where we were in the reruns, between those types of humor and the types of approach that the show took. So, and I loved it. I loved it. We watched it pretty much my entire childhood into my adulthood. I think there was a point though where I got a little burnt out on it because we did watch it consistently for so long that I haven't watched it in a while, as I said earlier. So listening to your show, I'm remembering all these things about it that I really loved, especially this first season is really, really fun.
What do you remember, like, when you were a kid? What about it appealed to you? One of the things I'm discovering from talking to different people is it really worked on little kids. And that's surprising to me because it's very serious and it's got references that no kid would have understood. And yet little kids really seem to have clicked in on it. Like, what do you remember? What do you just think it was funny, or was there more to it?
I'll tell you 2 stories. So I have had a lifelong love affair with Alan Alda. And when I was like 7, I was always a messy kid. So I had this picture of Alan Alda. I'm not even sure where I got it, but it was in color. So it was from a magazine, and I cut it out and I wrote something like, so stupid. I can't believe I'm admitting this. I made a little bubble, like a thought bubble. And I wrote, cleanliness is next to godliness. And I have Alan Alda saying it. And it was supposed to encourage me to clean my room. Just so stupid. I can't, saying it out loud now makes me feel really stupid. But at the time, he had such an influence on me. I had a mad crush on him. I still do. I follow him on Twitter. I think he's amazing. And so I think part of it was just kind of I was crushing on him. But also I think the early episodes are really kind of funny. And even though there's a lot of sexual innuendo in it, it seemed kind of harmless. In the same way, I think, even though it's different, you know, Three's Company was, it's all about sex. But it's done in a way, in Love Boat, in a way that, like, it's kind of innocent. And so even though I think MASH was more savvy about its line delivery and its implications, I think, though, it still seemed so harmless to me as a kid, like it wasn't upsetting. It wasn't talking about something that I didn't understand or know about. And so that was okay to me. And so, I think it was really just Alan Alda and the fact that it was strangely accessible. I will tell you, though, I noticed that there was no laugh track during the surgery scenes. So when I was little, I didn't really understand what a laugh track was. And so I thought that the audience was there, and I actually thought that they had brought benches out. And I've mentioned this on my show. And they would have the audience follow the sets, right? And they would watch and laugh where it was appropriate. And then there was no laughing in the surgery. So my mom's a nurse, right? And I think she liked it because of all the medical stuff. But I would ask her, how come nobody laughs during these scenes? And she looked at me one time, and she just said very seriously, she goes, because surgery isn't funny.
Right. She's right on the money there.
And so, you know, that was a life lesson for me. But so basically Alda and then it was funny. And I think also maybe it got more sober when I got old enough to kind of understand the nuances of it. I remember, and I don't want to spoil the episodes that are coming up, but I remember there was one where Alan Alda had like a cough he couldn't get rid of. Do you remember that?
Yes.
And it
yes.
ended up being yes. like a really, really tragic reveal. Why it,
right, a sublimated memory, right?
Yeah,
right.
And I probably would have been like 10 when I saw that episode, but like it had such an impact on me, like it really moved me. And then there was the dreams episode, right, which is so famous, and like it was dark, but I think I was just getting old enough that kind of that side of life and being exposed to that through like a dramatic performance where I was still removed from it was like really intriguing to me too, you know, sort of like filtering in these new emotions that I was going to start experiencing as I was getting older and more mature, I think.
Wow. Did you watch the final episode when it aired, like most of America?
Yes, of course I did. Yeah. I haven't actually seen it since, even though I have it. I just remember really at the end with the sandbags. That's the part I remember the most. And I loved it. And it was sad. Not as sad as the last episode of Magnum, which is like my all-time favorite show. But yeah, I was really sad to see it end.
Hmm. All right. Well, I love the idea of you like maybe writing the word "the swamp" on your door of your bedroom.
I was fully into it. It was really Alan Alda. But I will tell you, the older I get, Wayne Rogers, total honey. I didn't realize that. I did not realize that. And also, I have every episode of Trapper John. By the way, I'm actually more of a Trapper John fanatic than even a Smash fanatic. So.
Good to know. Interesting. Well, Margaret reveals later on that she has a big crush on Trapper, not so much Hawkeye. Now, she sleeps with Hawkeye later on, but who knows what would have happened with Trapper if she'd gone on. But when she gets drunk, she's like, I really could have gone for you. And Hawkeye's like, well, thank you. And she's like, no, not you, him. And she puts her arms around Trapper. And so she talks about his tousled hair and stuff like that. So, you know, yeah, people... Ladies love Wayne Rogers.
I get it. It's funny. I went running this morning. My running partner, I was talking about Alan Alda. We were talking about his bedroom eyes, right? And then I was like, but Wayne Rogers is even cuter. And she's like, I know.
Amazing. I never would have had that insight before on the show. That's really
That's cool. What I'm here for.
So, well, yeah, absolutely. So, well, awesome. Well, okay. I said, as I mentioned, we're here to talk about season one, episode 13, Edwina. Original air date, Christmas Eve, 1972, written by Hal Dresner and directed by James Sheldon. The 477th is throwing a birthday party for Nurse Edwina Ferguson. Special guest star, Arlene Galanka. She's a sweet girl, but a real klutz and clearly insecure. So much so that she runs off in tears during her own party. Nurse Cutler follows her out, asking her what the problem is, and Edwina reveals that, even though she's just a few weeks shy of going home, she is depressed. Edwina is lonely and has never attracted the attention of any of the men of the 477th, which has crushed her self-esteem. Shortly thereafter, all the various men of the 477th start getting suddenly rejected by all the women in their lives, and Radar overhears, via a hole in the nurse's shower, that the nurses have decided to cut off all the men until one of them steps up to the plate and romances Edwina. The men decide to hold a raffle to see who the lucky guy is, and of course, the winner is Hawkeye. Hawkeye schmoozes Edwina during lunch and dinner, trying his best to be funny and charming. Edwina is such a klutz, she barely notices, but finally Hawkeye gets to asking her out, and she accepts. That night, they each prepare for the date in royal style, each of them wearing kimonos. Hawkeye crosses the camp and picks Edwina up, bringing her back to the swamp. During the date, everything that could go wrong does, with Edwina accidentally elbowing Hawkeye in the eye, knocking him over, smashing a glass into the floor, which Hawkeye accidentally tramples on with bare feet, scaring him half to death. Hawkeye finally concludes that all this klutziness is some sort of defense mechanism of Edwina's, in an attempt to keep men away before they can hurt her. Edwina is touched by all the effort Hawkeye is making, and they share a gentle kiss where nothing goes wrong. Edwina is thrilled that she's capable of being affectionate and open with someone, and it doesn't immediately all go wrong. Of course, just as she discovers this, she knocks the swamp's chimney pipe over, spilling soot all over Hawkeye and his bed. Hawkeye can only laugh hysterically. Hawkeye nurse Cutler sees Edwina off. She heads for home, and Margie thanks Hawkeye for being so nice to Edwina. The enforced abstinence is finally over. So, okay, Amanda, you asked to talk about this one. Why this episode?
Because I pray to the altar of Arlene Golanka. I don't even...
Those words have never been put together in that order before.
I think they have. I don't really know why she's famous, like, to me, because she's not really starred in, like, a TV series or necessarily been in a... She's been in movies that I've seen, but, like, never as the lead. But over the years, she's become, like, just an actress that when she's on TV, I'm like, oh, yes, this is going to be so good. If nothing else, Arlene Golanka is going to be wonderful. And she's just adorable to look at, and she's so talented. And this is a really sweet episode. I didn't realize how sweet it was till I rewatched it. I watched it last night to prepare, and then I watched it again today just because it's so lovely. Although I don't know if I buy the, you're a klutz because you're trying to hurt guys physically before they're, I mean, that's really like psychology 101 stretched super thin, but I like it because
somebody call Sidney Friedman.
He could have handled it maybe better, but I like, the sort of little weird romance that they have that is sort of forced upon Hawkeye, but one which I think he grows to enjoy and embrace. Like when he's, you know, hitting on her when they're having food in the mess tent. It's so cute, you know, just the way he approaches her and how he tries to loosen her up with humor. And there's this really great moment where he says something to her about, do you want the coffee? And he makes a joke about how the coffee is the gravy that they didn't end up using on, you know, as the food and whatever. And she laughs and it kind of breaks the ice. And the two actors are so good, right? And you can feel like all this trepidation and self-doubt she has kind of like falling away because he's so charming, which might be one of the reasons why I fell in love with him myself. You know, the character is just so effortlessly charming. And then there's this great moment where she's eating the pork chop and she gets the piece of like the ketchup on the side of her mouth and he keeps rubbing the napkin on his own mouth and wiping his face because it's making him so uncomfortable to see this food on her face. But he's still like joking around with her and it's just really lovely. It gets a little Three's Company at the end there with all the goofy humor where he keeps like pratfalling because she's like breaking things and whatever. But yeah, it's just really cute. And I think she's so great and I wish she'd been in more episodes because I just want to watch her in everything. But she's for one guest appearance and to have as much as she had, I think she really carried the episode in a really great way. So yeah, it's just really sweet and I like it.
Well, that's one of the things that I noticed when rewatching all these is that in previous episodes, they're repetitive as television, of course, generally is series television is. It's the same story over and over again. But pretty much every episode to this point has been Hawkeye and Trapper doing a scam. You know, whether it's stealing Frank's blood or stealing Henry's desk or having Radar fake an illness to get Henry to come back. It's these two scoundrels going behind the scenes to do something not on the up and up, but for a good purpose. And as much as I've enjoyed all those episodes, and I have because I love the show, there's no episode of MASH I don't enjoy on some level. They are repetitive. This one, though, is a big break in that this is a character piece. And it's a character piece on a character that we've never seen before and will not see again. It really is kind of remarkable for them to hand the entire show over in the first season to a guest star and have virtually all the other characters, except for Hawkeye, take a back seat. I mean, Henry, Frank, Hot Lips, Radar, they're basically not even in this episode. It's all Hawkeye and Edwina. And I find that very charming and very form-busting to kind of have the audience and say, we're going to do this character piece now. And it would point the way to where MASH would go in the second, third, fourth, fifth, go on and on and on seasons of where it would be more about how these characters interact in any given situation as opposed to Hawkeye and Trapper trying to pull a fast one on everybody. Because that would get old really fast. But I mean, it's kind of remarkable that they would do a show like Edwina this early. I could see it in season 3, season 4, but the middle of season 1, that's pretty remarkable. And as you say, Arlene Golanka, it's funny, when I went back to look at her credits, because I've been doing, you know, researching, like, okay, what are the credits of everybody? I really thought she was, like, kind of in more stuff than she has been, because as you say, I've always known who she is, and I have to wonder if that's because of her name. her name is so distinctive. Yeah. Arlene Galanka. I mean, this Hollywood, from the everyone knows at this point that in the 30s and 40s and 50s, Hollywood would change the names of everybody because to make it sound more American, make it sound more, you know, quote unquote normal, mm-hmm. you know, like Archie Leach became Cary Grant and all, like Frances Gumm became Judy Garland. They didn't, you couldn't have a strange sounding name. In the 70s, that was kind of going away, but it was still in practice a little bit. So for this woman to kind of go through her career as Arlene Galanka was kind of like just by itself is a memorable thing.
Yeah, you know, she's it's interesting because I was going through her credits myself, too, because I was like, there must be one thing that I saw her in that really, like, hit me, and that's why she sticks with me. But it's not. It's a whole bunch of little things, which I think is really great. I love – so being a character actor can be really tough. And but our, because her name is so distinct, I think that helps, too, because we all remember the Galanka, right, just for the name. But, like, yeah. She's managed to, like, survive – in a business that's not super kind to women, especially when they're in supporting roles, and continue and be memorable in almost everything. And I mean, I think that's a testament to her talent. And so it's really nice to see her kind of take the lead in a way in something like a show as good as MASH and to kind of play against type. So I watched so she did a pilot that I'd never heard of until yesterday called Call Home with H-O-L-M-E with Artie Johnson. And it's kind of a spoof. It's sort of like Get Smart meets Sherlock Holmes. And it was bizarre. It has a lot of Hitler jokes, which surprised me. But yeah, but Arlene Galanka plays Holmes's secretary. And she's this kind of really pretty girl that's not really smart, but she can do her job really well. But in terms of handling her personal life, she's kind of a mess. And she kind of gets passed around between the guys, and it's questionable, right? But she's obviously a beautiful woman. And it's not like she looks bad in Edwina, but they really play down her beauty. I think she's wearing a wig. And she was also closer to 40 when she did this. So she says she's 28 at the beginning, but she was actually like 36. And I thought that was a really interesting choice because I think they wanted somebody who could be believable at 26, but probably look like maybe life had been a little harder on them.
Right.
You know, and so, and she carries that really well, but you know, like when she walked off the set, that blonde hair came down and she was gorgeous. And I love that she's so transformative in this episode. And I don't know that I always saw that with her. She always kind of played really physically attractive women. And here she's definitely, there's nothing wrong with her, but she really played down the looks and she just became like a different character. It's just really great.
I didn't even realize until I watched this just recently for this episode is that just by the fact that they call her Eddie, that's,
right.
You know, de-feminizing her. So they're giving her a male name. Her name is Edwina, not Eddie, but Eddie's kind of a male name. And it's because I think most of the men don't regard her as the great beauty. I mean, this episode, the other big part of this episode is from Marcia Strassman.
Yeah, so I love her.
Playing, and she's gorgeous. Yes. I mean, Marcia Strassman was so beautiful. And so compared to Arlene Galanka looks a little plain, and they give her that frumpy fatigue hat that they put her in. And so, yeah, they're always, you know, she's not being noticed by most of the camp. And that's actually a theme that MASH would return to way later in a season 11 episode with Nurse Kelly, where they would talk about how just because she wasn't a, you know, someone with a button nose and a perfect figure, the men in the camp didn't notice her. And of course, this plot is based on an old ancient text. It's based on Lysistrata, which is a comedy by Aristophanes, which was originally performed in classical Athens in 411 BC about how women, in an attempt to stop the men from going to war, cut them off sexually. So that's how old the story is.
Spike Lee just did that, right? With the Nick Cannon. I can't even remember the name of the movie now that came out a couple years ago. He took that story and redid it. It was about like gang warfare. Do you remember this?
I'm sure I've heard of this movie, but I didn't know that was the plot. I don't know which one of that. Geez, I don't know which movies of that is.
I'm going to feel really stupid if I got it wrong, but I'm pretty sure that Spike Lee was based it off that play. I think. Cool. And Nick Cannon started it. And that's why it sticks out in my mind because Nick Cannon's a comedian. And he was taking like a classical text with Spike Lee. and then doing something with it. But of course, now I can't remember the name of it. Somebody's going to listen to this and be like, you got that so wrong, Amanda. It's actually, you know what I mean? It's actually based on Across 110th Street or something, you know, and I'll feel stupid. But, you know, the thing you say about Nurse Kelly is funny because that's the episode I remember actually even more than Edwina. And I remember that because my dad was watching it with me. And that thing about the button nose, that line always sticks out to me because my dad, when we watched it, he turned to me and he's like, I don't like button noses. You know, he was very specific. Okay. He didn't. He liked women like Barbara Stanwyck. Who was the other woman he liked? They had very strong noses, like they were larger noses. They look great. You know, they're beautiful women, but he was really into that. And so maybe Barbara Streisand, women like that. So, but he made a very specific point to call that out watching that when it originally aired. And I remember that line so well because of it. Plus, she kind of had a button nose.
Yeah, no, she's cute. It's like, if you can get past the whole thing of her with the food where she throws the salt over her shoulder and she's just not paying, she's so not used to men paying attention to her that she doesn't know how to interact on that level. And you realize that she's somebody that once you just sit and try and talk to her, she's charming and she's nice and she's funny. And that's all that it took was somebody to just put the time in to talk to her. And that's, you know, and that's very humane and very sweet. And that's what I like about this episode is that it is just kind of this nice little character piece between Alda and Galanka. I wanted to mention some of her other credits. You mentioned a couple things she was in. She was in the movie Welcome to Hard Times. She was in Hang 'Em High with Clint Eastwood. And then a lot of TV. Mayberry, That Girl, The Big Valley, Love American Style, Maud, Alice, The Rockford Files, Trapper John, of course, yeah. Fantasy Island. And she was in some movie called The Hoboken Chicken Emergency, which I don't know. No idea what that is, but I just like saying Hoboken Chicken Emergency. By the way, the movie you're talking about, the Spike Lee movie, is called Chirac. That's the movie based on Liz Estrada.
Yeah. So.
But yeah, this is a really cute episode, and it's fun to watch the actors, the men try and connect up with the women, and the women are a unified front. I do wonder about the scene where Radar hits on the one nurse, which is a very un-Radar-y thing to do, and it's the whole gag with the microscope where he gives the nurse a slide, and it's like busy later, and then she gives him a slide, and they both have to look in the microscope, and it says get lost, and I wonder about how does one write a message that you need a microscope to look at. I don't know how even the physics of that, but it's a cute plot. It's really, really, it's a fun, nice, sweet episode.
It's funny what you say about Radar though, because that shocked me because I remember him as being so innocent and he's like looking through a hole in the curtain in the tent to watch the women shower. And like, I'm like, Radar did that. But I think at the beginning, wasn't he a little more like one of the guys?
Yes.
Yeah.
Much more the wheeler dealer. He was still playing kind of the Radar from the movie, who was much more one of the kind of gang and in on the kind of dirty jokes. It would, over the course of the season, they would sort of childlike him up a little. In fact, actually, the very next episode, Love Story, is a big step in that direction. But he's still kind of, a little bit of like a wheeler dealer and a little bit of a kind of a gentle perv with the whole looking through the hole in the nurse's shower thing. He talks about that he got his eye poked because he was looking there and stuff. This episode was written by Hal Dresner, who I've talked about in previous episodes. This was the last MASH that he ever wrote. He wrote the unfortunately titled The Extraordinary Seaman, which starred Alan Alda, which, of course, I just talked about in a special episode of the MASHcast because I was so fascinated by what a bizarre movie that is and it has all these MASH connections. But it's too bad that Hal Dresner didn't write more because I think this is, again, like I said, this is a really nice piece, and I think it took a lot of skill to pull this off.
Yeah, it's like laugh out loud funny too. Like, so when I go back to rewatch MASH, of course I laugh at certain things, but there were just things in this that just had me genuinely laughing, even though I kind of knew what was going to happen because I've seen this episode probably 15 times in my life. And I love that it just has a real timeless quality to it. And I'm not saying the other episodes don't, but there's just something about this one that sticks out to me as just, I don't know, maybe because I like romance. And, you know, you don't really get that. Like the women come and go on this show so often that, you know, you don't really get a feel for like that. You get it. He's charming, but he's kind of a scoundrel, you know? And so like, and that's fine. But here you get this idea that like, he could be like a really great romantic lead in something. You know what I mean? So as a child, I guess that's a really good introduction to Alan Alda's like diversity, which was really cool. And, you know, I don't know. I just keep saying it because I just think it's so sweet. I don't know if that like is a turnoff for people, but I guess I tend to go to the more innocent, side of life. I don't know. I like it over there. So like, it's just hilarious because I'm a huge horror movie fanatic too, but I do like just really, there's an innocence there that feels so untouched. And I think that that's so nice. And like you said, it's skilled and it's hard to do that, especially in a show like MASH, which, and I know you've talked about this before, but you know, it takes place in the Korean War, but it's really commenting on Vietnam. And it was a way to introduce it into the conversation without really getting people up in arms because it was so divisive. And so they used another war to bring in a dialogue. So a lot of the show could get, even the early episodes could get dark and serious. And so here they're kind of walking away from that and they're showing like just a more human side to what happens with some people in during wartime. That's kind of nice.
Right. And then of course they it completely changes tone in the second half of the show where they go on the date and it becomes this massive slapstick comedy. I mean, and Alan Alda was really good at that too. I mean, the guy was good at everything.
Yeah, he was.
He's Alan Alda.
Yeah.
But I mean, just all the stuff about where she elbows him in the eye and then he touches the stove that's super hot. And then the whole thing about the where she breaks the martini glass and he steps on it with his bare feet. And like that, I don't know. I love horror movies too. And I don't get squeamish easily, but there's something about walking on broken glass, the John McClane Die Hard thing, that really makes me kind of like, ugh. Because it just, the Alan Alda really sells it, where he's like, yeah, and she's like, your feet must be cut to ribbons. He's like, yeah, he's probably bleeding profusely from his feet at this
point. Well, it's funny because he props up his feet at one point, and I looked, and I don't see anything. And I'm like,
no, right.
I'm like, good going. But, you know, just to reference a little before the date when they're both getting ready. So there's this part where they're playing like, I don't know, it's not mariachi music. It's something like that, like Matador music. And they're getting ready.
Matador music.
Yeah, for the date. And they hand him this fatigue t-shirt, which is hilarious. But after they get him in the kimono and they're walking to her tent, if you notice, Wayne Rogers is laughing. And
oh no, I didn't.
Yeah,
that.
It feels really genuine. It doesn't feel like acting. It feels like it's just they're having a good time, and it's kind of contagious. And so he's looking over at Alan Alda in this kimono and those shoes, and there's just this kind of smile that he has, and it's really it adds, I think, to the humor and the good nature of it. You know, it's kind of what you were saying about like how you get kind of sensitive to the fact that Frank Burns gets picked on for really good reasons, but he also gets picked on for no reason at all. And so he never gets a chance to really like fit in. And I think sometimes it's nice to see like just a sort of genuine gentleness to the characters. And I feel like you get that when you're watching this particular scene, when they're all kind of like getting him ready for the date and stuff. And it's really cute and sweet. And I think it softens up all of them in that scene.
Oh, I love, yeah, I just noticed what you're talking about. You do see Wayne Rogers laugh, which I really enjoy. He does that in a lot of episodes where he seems to be genuinely laughing. But I love that when they're walking Hawkeye to her tent, you see every man in the unit with his poking around the corner, sticking their head out of their door. There's one guy, like, crouched behind a Jeep. Like, everybody in the tent is in on this. That's really funny. Like, you all know that, like, I always wonder, like, not to be grotesque, but, like, what are they hoping happens with Hawkeye and Edwina in the swamp? Because, first of all the flaps are up.
That's what
so
I was thinking.
So everybody can see into the tent. Are they supposed to, like, actually have sex? I don't know what, like, what exactly are they hoping to happen in this episode, in this date?
Yeah, you know, I thought that too with the flaps because I hadn't really considered that because he brings women over from time to time and Marcia Strassman was there earlier. And it's pretty, it's such a weird tent, first of all, because I don't know how many tents are see-through and it doesn't look like any of the other tents really have that. They're like Margaret's tent is always closed off.
Right.
You know, and I guess it just seems so unusual, but I today or last night I had that thought to myself about like how they and Hawkeye's, you know, a ladies' man, so like how many women came into that tent and like stuff happened and people could kind of get a general gist of it. You know what I mean? And it's like, I don't know how into that I am, but it was kind of like, it really stuck out to me in this one, especially with her, because everybody is waiting to see what happens.
Yeah. Yeah. I also love that Eddie, as presented as, you know, oblivious to a lot of things, but she figures it out very quickly into the date, where she splashes Hawkeye with the martini, and as he's washing his face off, she's putting her flip-flops back on, and he's like, Eddie, what's going on? She goes, okay, Hawkeye, I get it. You know, I'll tell everybody I had a wonderful... Like, I like that moment that she's not that oblivious. She knows, okay, this was all set up so Margie and the girls can get back to normal and everything is fine. I love that, too. That's a nice detail on the Margie's on the part of Margie.
Yeah, I think the thing that's so great about her too is that she is clumsy and stuff. But like even when she has that opening monologue, after the party when she runs out crying and she's talking about the guy she was engaged to and how she
Seymour.
Yeah, and you don't get the idea that she is dumb, although she's a questionable nurse because he asked for like a clamp or something. She handed him forceps. Yes. And I thought, that's really bad. And then originally I thought he was still using the forceps on the person he was operating on. But when I watched it again today, I could see that the other nurse handed him the right instrument. But I was like, is he just using that because he's afraid to say, please give me the clamp? But I thought, wow, she's a questionable nurse. But she does, like, she's not stupid. She's just, like, clumsy. And I think it fills her full of self-doubt.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, obviously, I can't. One of the things that I've always liked about MASH as a kid is that you feel like, hey, look, I mean, I would never want to be there, obviously. I don't want to be part of a war in any aspect. But at the same time, when I was a kid, I couldn't help admit, like, being at the 477 looked like a fun kind of place. Outside the surgery, it looked like kind of, you know, the people were cool, everybody was nice to one another, and you would want to be there. But I would also see that it was kind of a closed group, and not everybody fit in. At times, and they would do other episodes about some characters didn't fit in with the general gist of it. And I would imagine being so far away from home in a war, if you don't feel like you fit in with the gang, that would be very unsettling and very unnerving. And I would probably be more like Eddie. I would just be like a klutz because I would be so worried about fitting in with everybody else. So that's, again, it's a very nice detail. I mean, she's lucky she's getting to go home. Already, yeah. You know, that's kind of cool. This is pretty early in the war and she's already getting shipped home, but presumably maybe she was serving in another capacity and she's filling out the rest of her service here at the 477. So, but yeah, it's really sweet. And then their final kiss where they just have the little kiss and Alan Alda just says, that was nice. He's just really, really good. And you can see that his influence is already spreading into the show.
Right.
You know, his general persona. He was such a force of personality that even though him and Wayne Rogers were supposed to be co-equals, the show, he was such a magnet that the show couldn't help but start bending in his direction because he was just such a compelling performer. And as I've mentioned in other episodes, when he gets the soot dumped on him, he seems to be genuinely laughing.
Yeah.
That's hard to do. That is really hard to make it sound like you've genuine, and especially when, like, they probably had to get that in one shot. So they probably had to rehearse that really specifically because they couldn't have him dumped with all that ash and all the bed. They'd have to clean it up a bunch of times. So Alan Alda really sells that final moment.
You know, so the laughter, whenever I hear Alan Alda laugh like that, it always makes me think of the episode, and I don't know the story, but you probably do because you know the show so well, when Frank Burns puts on the helmet and the eggs are in it.
Oh, right. Yeah.
it feels so improvised. Like the laughing feels so natural when he's like cracking up. But just to go back to Trapper John, I feel like they probably did a disservice to the character because I feel like Trapper John is maybe a little too cynical. And he's, even though he and Hawkeye are a lot alike, I feel like they're a lot different too. And it probably benefits Hawkeye that he was single because Trapper is just a scoundrel in a lot of ways. And so I think it was harder to warm to his character in a lot of ways because of the way it just was written, you know, for him. And so I didn't know that Wayne Rogers, I didn't know why he left. I didn't know any of that. And you have talked about on the show about that he was dissatisfied with a lot of things. And I think he thought he was going to be one of the leads and then he got pushed in the back. And it's no fault of the actor at all. I think obviously he's very charming and he's really talented, but I just feel like the character, it's like Frank Burns, not as bad. I feel like he got written into a corner. And I feel like when they revamped the show as it went along, like, so Winchester is like a happy medium, you know, between Frank Burns and making him like another Hawkeye. So you got to get a guy that's like kind of uptight, but he can still fit in, and he's also a very skilled surgeon, and he's not as hard to swallow. He's easier to like. And I think BJ came in and they just sort of revamped Trapper by making him more committed to his marriage and a kind of a softer version of him. And so I think they were thinking about what they did wrong with. So I really feel like maybe it's the writers that it was unfortunate, or when they were creating the characters. And you would know better if Trapper John was like that in the movie. I don't really remember. But
well, he's ostensibly the main character in the movie. It really, once Elliot Gould comes into the movie, it really is more Trapper than it is BJ. Than it is Hawkeye. And it's just, they just, by casting Alan Alda, I just think they sort of accidentally put all their weight onto him, because he was just so, he was so creative, had so many ideas, and was, he just grabbed that part by the throat. And I think Wayne Rogers was more willing to kind of just say, okay, what are the writers going to give?
Right.
And of course he was, that doesn't make it, that's not better or worse. It's just Alan Alda was much more comfortable as a writer and a director, as opposed to Wayne Rogers, who was really, quote unquote, just an actor.
Yeah. He became so much more influential on the show, Alan Alda. Like, he really took hold. I mean, I keep going back to Magnum, but you know, when Tom Selleck started on Magnum, it was a great detective show. But as the years passed and he became so popular, they gave him a lot of creative leeway. Sure. And he changed the show a lot, especially around the fifth season. And you can feel his influence on the show. You can feel it. It's so intense and amazing. And I think Alan Alda is very much the same way, you know, like he came on. And I don't know how soon he got involved with the creative process, but he really, I think, had a lot to do with the way the show went. And something I wanted to mention really briefly, because she's not really spotlighted in the show, but, you know, I'm a huge fan of Loretta Swit. And there's these MeTV shows, MASH, and for a while they were showing these clips of the actors at the interview talking about, you know, their memories of the show. And, you know, Loretta Swit had to fight really hard to make Margaret Houlihan more dimensional. And her character has the most transformation as the show progresses. And Alan Alda had mentioned that she actually fought really hard, because I don't think they necessarily wanted her to change that much. But she was like, I think she felt like she was going to end up like Frank Burns and kind of end up in a corner. And so she's like, I really need you guys to do this, and I need this. And so when you were talking about the not fitting in thing, you know, they dealt with that with her, because there's that great episode where she's not fitting in, and she's like, you never even asked me for a cup of coffee. She's talking to the nurses.
Right, right.
It's such a famous line and scene. And like, and the character had to really, like, she was on the outside and had to work her way in. And it's really brilliant the way they did it. Her transformation is so natural and real. And she saw over that a lot. And I think Alan Alda helped her with that. I think he respected that. And I think they worked together. I don't know that, but that's my impression. And so I feel like he just exerted so much creativity himself, you know, over the process. So as it grows, it feels so much more natural, because he was looking at it from all these different angles.
Yeah, it would have been interesting if, like, they had given Trapper this episode, but I don't know if it would have worked exactly the same. And we'll get on to, in later seasons, there are episodes where Trapper gets to do something really interesting, and Wayne Rogers knocks it out of the park. He does it really well. So it's like, he was certainly capable of all this. You just didn't give him that much to do. And so I have to wonder what, you know, Wayne Rogers, even this early on, an episode like this where it's all about Hawkeye, he must have been sitting there kind of like, oh boy, you know, like, with just kind of wondering, is the writing on the wall already? We're halfway through season one and it's already Hawkeye, Hawkeye, Hawkeye. But
it's interesting that you bring this up, because Wayne Rogers did a TV show called House Calls.
Sure, right.
That I watched, and I think I loved it. I think it was too sophisticated for me, but I watched it. And the first, I don't know how long it was on, but like the first half of the series was Lynn Redgrave was the woman that starred in it with him.
I think so, yeah.
And they had, I believe they had creative differences, and she left the show, or she was let go. I can't remember which one it was. And Sharon Gless came in and replaced her. And so when you're talking about this, it makes me think of lessons learned when he was on MASH. So she said in an interview, like in TV Guide, that he didn't want just any woman coming into the show. He wanted an actress that he felt like he could really work with and that had the same kind of ideas as him and vision and blah, blah, blah. And so he had her come out to dinner with her, and they sat down and they had a very serious talk about the show. And so it really hinged on whether or not he was going to accept her as a peer. And so I'm thinking about that now, and what you're saying about MASH and how he was just kind of taking it probably for, oh, here's my script, blah, blah, blah. Let me see what I have and let me do this. And I wonder if like he felt kind of burned by that. And then he started to feel like he had to be more involved in the process.
Yeah, I would make sense. I mean, they could probably get a lot of actors that realize that the writers aren't going to necessarily go. I mean, the writers are just trying to get it done. They're just trying to grind the sausage out week by week. And, you know, you probably as an actor, you have to be protective of your part in this because otherwise you could get pushed by the wayside. And, you know, maybe some people did it a little more gently than others. But we've all heard the stories of actors that really had to fight for their characters and things like that. I mean, we're getting way afield, but it's on my mind now is that I did an interview with Elias Davis, one of MASH's writers. And I asked him about an episode that he wrote in season 10 called Where There's a Will, There's a War, where Hawkeye writes his will. And he leaves different items to the members of the 477th. And then we see in flashbacks, you know, here I give my robe to Father McKay, or I give my 5 cents to Father McKay, I give my robe to Winchester. And it's all these flashbacks. And I asked Elias Davis, was there ever any consideration when you were working on the episode of like getting the older actors to come back because it's all flashbacks. You could have done a flashback with Trapper John. You could have done a flashback. It would have been probably a ratings bonanza to bring one of the old cast members back because you could do it. And he was like, oh no. He's like, we never even thought of it. He's like, we were just trying to get scenes for all the main actors. That wasn't even a consideration. And it's like, yeah, because back then they were just trying to get, they were cranking out 24 shows a season. They were just trying to get it done. So I could see that maybe unless you were an actor like Alan Alda who could, and then as you're talking about later on, Loretta Swit, had the presence of mind to stop and say, wait, hold on, this has got to get fixed. Then you could just kind of get ground up in the churn of television production, and you know, you would lose out. So it's obviously it worked out for the show because the show went on for 11 seasons, and Alan Alda became, you know, one of the great creative forces behind it, and certainly the face of it. And everybody still knows about him from him and MASH are irreparably connected. But yeah, and so this is an early indication of sort of, I think, his influence. Do you have before we wrap up on this one, do you have a particular favorite line, either a joke or not, just a favorite line of dialogue?
Yeah, I don't remember exactly, but like when they're sitting in the mess hall and he's sort of like warming her up, and he's talking about, he's like, well, you just see this side of me. Underneath that, there's another layer, and I'm sensitive and whatever. And she's like, and conniving. And he's like, but underneath that, there's another layer. And he's like, and then underneath that is parking. And I love that. I just love that line. It made me laugh so hard.
That's funny because I wrote that same line down. That's my favorite line too. He's like, underneath all that, of course, is public parking. Yeah. I love that idea because it's like he's seeing if she's paying attention because he's laying it on and he's like, oh, I'm just a glib operator. And like by the fact that she laughs, it's like, all right, they are engaged with one another in this conversation. It's really very sweet. And it's just a funny joke. Just underneath all that, of course.
Yeah, well, it's just funny. Like, it's unexpected. And I like that there are some of the, he'll make jokes and she won't respond at all. And then he'll make a joke and she'll kind of like let her guard down just a couple times, you know? And so it's just such a real interaction, you know, because he has to work hard to kind of get her trust and to get her. And at the beginning, like with the coffee I was talking about, she laughs at the line about the gravy, but then she kind of goes back to, oh, I'm just wondering why you want to sit with me. You could sit with these people or you could do this. And then she's kind of still doing it. And then the guard goes down again. And then like, and it's just, it kind of keeps you watching both of them pretty intensely because you want to see like the responses. It's not the same response every time, you know? And I agree with you. It's just a really funny line.
It's a really sweet episode, and it would really point the way to where MASH would go in later seasons and stuff. And so I think it's a really terrific show. And again, I am amazed at the bravery it took to so early on in a show's history where the ratings were not good, it was struggling to stay on the air, that they would devote a whole episode to a guest star like this. That's pretty unusual, and I think it worked out really well. So
when you've got the Golanka, you're in. You better take advantage of it.
We've got the Galanka, everybody. Alert, everybody. CBS, we've got the Galanka. So, well, Amanda, thank you so much for coming on. I always enjoy talking to you. I love your show, and you did a Film and Water with me, which was great. We were talking about a TV movie, and I was really happy that you wanted to do an episode of MASHcast, because this is, I always enjoy talking to you. You're a great podcaster, and you do great audio commentaries. For everybody who doesn't know, Amanda has done audio commentaries for a bunch of movies on have they all just been Shout Factory releases? Tell people what movies you've done commentaries.
Okay, yeah, I've been working mostly for Arrow and Shout Factory. So for Arrow, I did the Last House on the Left commentary with my good friend Bill Ackerman, who does a podcast called Supporting Characters that's really good. And I actually met him because he interviewed me for that. And then we became really friendly, and now we talk all the time. We did this commentary. It was wonderful. That's a rough movie. It was hard to do.
Hell yeah.
It was hard to do the commentary, but it was really worthwhile to me to do it because I'm a huge Wes Craven fan. But I mostly do TV movies with Shout Factory. So I did The Spell, which was the first commentary I did with them. That came out, 2017. It came out last year, about a year ago. And then I did Someone's Watching Me, which is a John Carpenter TV movie that's so good. And even if you never listen to the commentary on there, you should definitely pick it up because it's such a great film. And if you're a Carpenter fan, you'll see so much of where he was going to go because it's a real early film for him. And there's a lot of stuff in there that he would use later. He was really working out some stuff. And then most recently, I did another commentary, non-TV, with Shout Factory, with my friend Justin Kurzweil, who does the Hysteria Continues podcast, which is this fantastic slasher movie podcast. And the movie's called Scream for Help. It's a Michael Winner kind of oddity. And it's a really bizarre film, and it was really fun to do that. And it made me really fall in love with Michael Winner because I had to go and sort of rewatch and watch a lot of his stuff and read his biography, and it was great. So, yeah, I do that, and I write liner notes for Arrow sometimes and things like that. So thank you for mentioning it. And I love your shows. They're great. The MASH one's really great. It's really getting me excited about watching the show again. You know, you see something so many times, you think, okay, I think I'm probably never going to go back to that. But then you hear the conversations and you're like, yeah, you know what? That was such a good episode. Or I forgot how much I loved Hawkeye or whatever, you know? And so I think it's a very contagious, your show, and I'm really glad that you're doing it.
Well, thank you. Yeah, this was one of these, like, I've always wanted to do it. And when the 35th anniversary of the final episode hit this year, I was like, all right, I have to just do this. I have to finally do it. And I will tell everybody, I buy any movie that Amanda does the commentary for, even if I don't really care that much about the movie. I bought The Spell, never having even heard of it. But I was like, oh, Amanda's doing the commentary, I'll buy it. And I just sat there, and I've been enjoying it. I'm going to pass on the last.
Okay, I understand.
I saw that movie one time. That's all I ever need to see it. It's fine. But the rest of them, they're really, really fun. And I think that with movies going more and more to just streaming, I love that Shout Factory and Arrow are out there, and they're doing these deluxe presentations of movies, especially obscure stuff like this.
Yeah.
I grew up on that stuff. I worked at a video store, and I loved all that kind of stuff. And so I'm really happy that there are still some companies out there that are fighting the good fight. So anytime Amanda does an audio commentary, I'm buying the DVD.
Aww.
That is, or the Blu-ray. That
Thank
is,
you.
Is an instant buy. So, and tell people about your show, where they can find your podcast.
Oh, sure. Well, I guess you should just Google the Made for TV Mayhem Show. We have a Facebook page and we're on Twitter. I think the Twitter is TV Mayhem Podcast. I can never remember the URL for the actual website. I never can. But you'll find links to it on my social media. I also just have a regular Facebook page called Made for TV Mayhem, which is for my blog, which I haven't been able to update in forever. But if you go on there, I try to post updates on things. Like, I'm going to be giving a couple talks here coming up soon, and I'm going to be on Eli Roth's History of Horror, if anybody's interested in that. I don't know when this goes out, but it premieres October 14th and on AMC.
This will be right around then.
Oh, good. Okay. And it's I'm in the first episode. I don't know if I made it into any of the other episodes, but I talk about slasher movies on that. And so if you follow me, you can see all that stuff that I'm doing.
Very cool, very cool. And I will say when I'm listening to Made for TV Mayhem, I will listen to, most of the time, the movies you guys cover, I've never seen. You know, I'm just like, no idea. So, but I listen anyway. And then I will, you'll mention something, and I will go on IMDb, and I'll look up this movie you're talking about, because I get a little more familiar with it. And then I go down the rabbit hole.
Yeah.
Of like links to links to links, and you covered some movie, I forget which one it was, and it led me to another TV movie called Better Late Than Never, which is...
Yeah, it was the commentary, I think, because it's a John Carpenter wrote it.
Right. John Carpenter wrote this TV movie about old people, and in the cast is Harry Morgan. And I'm like, never in my wildest dreams did I think Harry Morgan and John Carpenter ever crossed over, ever, for any reason. And nevertheless, so now I'm like, I have to see this movie. I have to find This Better Late Than Never, just so I can hear the words of John Carpenter come out of Sherman Potter's mouth.
Oh, that'd be
when are we ever gonna
great.
Hear?
You know what? If you find it, let me know, because I can't find it anywhere. And so I was able to get enough information for it to talk about it on the commentary, because I can get into old databases at the library. I work for a college, and they have a really great library database, and so I could find old trade magazines and stuff. But I can't find this movie anywhere, and it stars Harold Gould, who's like so amazing, and it was directed by Richard Crenna, and you know, it's amazing, right? And like
the cast is unbelievable. Harold Gould, Strother Martin, Tyne right. Daly, Harry Morgan, Marjorie Bennett, Victor Buono, Jeanette Nolan, Donald Pleasance.
Yes, like, oh my Donald God. Pleasance, what? Right? And
what a cast!
And it's like I can't find it. So like, if anybody sees a copy of it anywhere, you have to let us know, because it must be must see TV. It must be.
Yes. Oh, it's unbelievable. So yeah, I love listening to your show.
Oh, thanks.
Like I said, I follow links, and then all of a sudden an hour's gone by, and I'm like, oh crap! I'm looking up obscure things. So well, we're gonna have the link to Made for TV Mayhem on the show notes. I'm sure I'll make sure I get the link.
Oh great!
So
I never do.
So thank you for coming on. I always love talking to you.
Thank you.
All right, everybody. Well, if you want to listen to back episodes of the show, of course, go to the website, fireandwaterpodcast.com. And we are always talking MASH over on Twitter, which is at @MASH477cast. So thanks, everybody, for listening. And until next week, that is all.
Talking to myself.
Well, I'm just trying to figure out why you're sitting here. You usually eat with Marjorie, one of the other girls.
Well, you're one of the other girls.
Why don't I believe you?
That's because you believe in the popular notion of me as a glib, insincere operator.
That's right.
Those are only some of my qualities. Underneath, there's another me. Shy, sensitive, uncertain.
Conniving.
Right. But underneath that, there's another me. Underneath there, of course, there's public parking. Ha ha.